Well, welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I am Andrew Rennie. Now, four letters sum up the bulk of this evening's The Space Show. A-R-I-A.
Nessun dorma, nessun dorma. Tu pure, o principessa, nella tua fredda stanza, guardi le stelle che tremano d'amore. Ma il mio mistero è chiuso in me, il nome mio nessun saprà, nonno, sulla tua bocca lo dirò quando la luce splenderà. Bacio scioglierò il silenzio che ti fa mia. Dire quando all'alba vincerò, vincerò, vincerò.
If you type the letters A, R, I, A into your favourite internet search engine, it will return lots of returns for long songs for solo voice in opera or oratorio. Now keep scrolling down and clicking next and then next again if you need to. You will eventually come to a link to do with the Apollo moon flights. A, R, I-A, or aria, is the word for song, derived from Italy in the 18th century. Now, we've just heard Luciano Pavarotti giving us a splendid example written by Giacomo Puccini. A-R-I-A, or aria, is an acronym for Apollo Range Instrumentation Aircraft. To support the Apollo missions to the moon, it was necessary to have tracking stations around the world. When the spacecraft was beyond 16,000 kilometres from Earth, three stations sufficed to do this. They were located at 120 degrees longitude spacing around the world, in Madrid, Goldstone and Canberra. The Canberra one was at Honeysuckle Creek. On the way out from Earth and on return, additional tracking was needed. To this end, tracking stations were built in Florida, Grand Bahama, Bermuda, Canary Islands, Carnarvon in Western Australia, Hawaii, Mexico, and Texas. To fill the oceanic gaps in this network, four ships were stationed at sea. This left gaps in the coverage. Buried away on page 179 of the Apollo 11 press kit was a description of how it was filled in. And that was by these Araya aircraft, the Apollo range instrumentation aircraft. Well, during 1970, in April of that year, Apollo 13 was en route to the moon for what was intended to be mankind's third landing on the moon. But an explosion in an oxygen tank left the spacecraft crippled. The world waited anxiously for several days as Apollo 13 looped around the moon and headed back towards home. When Apollo 13 approached Earth, it was high over Australia, and it was tracked by Honeysuckle Creek in the Australian Capital Territory. As it plunged toward the Pacific Ocean and the waiting rescue ships, Apollo 13 dropped below Honeysuckle's horizon. To continue to track the capsule as it blazed an ionization trail into the atmosphere, Araya were deployed. As you listen to this recording I made off the Voice of America's live shortwave radio broadcast, take note of the mentions of Araya. We pick up with the commentary when Apollo 13 can no longer be tracked from Honeysuckle Creek.
And Houston, we've just had loss of signal from Honeysuckle with Apollo 13. Our last velocity reading was 35,837 feet per second with a range to go of 1,791 nautical miles.
Up out of a speed of 39,326 kilometers per hour. The flash point 21 degrees 66 minutes south, 165 degrees 47 minutes west longitude.
Carrier Iwo Jima standing by on station. Araya aircraft, uprange and downrange rescue aircraft,
and a little ship out there too. You certainly want to mention the Liberty ship, the USS Paul, which is a backup recovery vessel, which we haven't mentioned before, and those Samoa rescue aircraft, the C-130. Of course, incidentally, Dick, our Voice of America figure is one of the principal methods of these people out there on that carrier right now, keeping up with what happened.
Apollo 13 should have entered the Earth's atmosphere at this time. Period of blackout for the spacecraft should have begun about 20-some-odd seconds ago.
The entry has progressed 3 minutes and 20 seconds now, about another 10 minutes of flash, according to the best estimate from the mission control countdown clock.
Less than 10 seconds now, we will attempt to contact Apollo 13 through one of the Araya aircraft. Continue to monitor this Apollo control, Houston.
As soon as they get a signal, we'll hear it right here.
Now, they're out of range. Apollo 13 should be out of blackout at this time. We're standing by for any reports of Araya acquisition. The Araya, C-135-type aircraft. Coming up now on 3 minutes until time of drogue deployment.
And you see the Earth's
any reports.
You can see the horizon, Mr. Kelly, but now this late in the entry, the spacecraft is coming more vertically down, and it's much more difficult to see the Earth. Actually.
We've had a report that Araya 4 aircraft has acquisition of signal.
Araya aircraft number 4 has acquisition of signal. Now, there's no tracking at this point. It's strictly communications.
Not as the Houston standing by.
They can actually track in the Araya spacecraft. They can get radar locked. And, they can do a directional picture. There was
That was Jim Lovell responding with the OK Joe.
Jim Lovell.
I've directed him. That was command module pilot Jack Swagger. Looking at the weather on TV, it looks just as advertised.
Real quick. Joe Kerwin in Mission Control talking to the astronauts in space.
And we heard Joe Kerwin's account of that event right here on the Space Show on our program of April the 22nd. Stan Anderson was facilities manager in Araya Control. Last year, the Space Show accompanied Stan as he visited Sandringham College and spoke to the students. And what a fascinating tale he had to tell. Although the technical quality of this recording is not up to our usual standard, I do hope you find Stan's account of Araya worth sticking with us. The occasional interjections, by the way, are by Sandringham College teacher Len Halperin.
They had 11 ground stations starting over here. And what you see is those circles are the range that station could see it when the satellite went over. And you'll see you get squiggly lines like this one here at Ascension. That was because there was a mountain in the way. Now, believe it or not, most of these huge antennas they had were built in valleys, not on mountaintops. You would think, well, logically, you want to put them on the mountaintop, you can see farther. But the fact is, by building them in the valleys, they were using terrain masking to filter out any extraneous radio and television and stuff like that.
Can I just say, to interrupt for a second, I've been to Honeysuckle Creek many times, and a high technology area that got the pictures from the moon, your phones don't work there. It says no service. It's in a valley, and there's no radio reception. So that's why they put it there.
Okay, but what they did was, if you start in the upper left-hand corner here, that's the station at Bermuda. They had a big station at Bermuda. The second one, the round circle, is actually a ship. They had three ships that were capable of tracking. They had one that was always in the recovery area, but they had three that had big antennas on them, and that was from the ship Vanguard. The next circle over, the third one, is in the Canary Islands. This one down here is Ascension Island, down in the South Atlantic. Incidentally, Ascension Island is so far out, the nearest land was St. Helena, where they exiled Napoleon. Then we go over, but look, there's a great big gap all the way over here to Carnarvon, up in northwest Australia. And then here we have, actually it was a combination of burying three. You had Honeysuckle Creek, you had Tidbinbilla, an antenna that was just coming up, and also the big antenna at Parks was just coming online at the time. And so you continue on, and that next circle up there, that's a station at Guam. And finally, we have one outside of, on the Big Island at Hawaii. And going back over, you have the next one is Goldstone, Corpus Christi, Texas, Merritt Island. But you'll notice that every one of those, heck, look right here. Look at Honeysuckle Creek. They were in a valley. And you can just see how erratic. Once the satellite crossed that boundary, no communications. And so this is why NASA came up with a variety of different stations. Okay, first of all, like at Carnarvon, they had 11 of these that had a 9-meter dish. And it would rotate as it come over. Now, if it went right straight over, they could track that satellite for 6 minutes. So any activity they wanted, they could contact it for 6 minutes. Now, the farther away it was from the zenith, the less time they had, because the circle gets smaller the closer you get to the edge. Okay, this is one of the 26-meter dishes that they had for the deep space network, basically Honeysuckle, Madrid, and Goldstone. And this one is actually, you can go down and see that if you get up to Tidbinbilla, because it's still there. They took down the Honeysuckle Creek station in 1981, but they saved this antenna because it actually has a certain amount of historical value. And they actually used it to track space missions until 2010. Then, of course, we had the big ones at Parks and Tidbinbilla. That's a 70-meter antenna. Can you imagine something almost the size of a football pitch and moving it? And that was those are the big ones. That's what helped augment the smaller 26-meter dish antennas. Okay. Then they had four ships. Three of them had 9-meter antennas on them. And they would go in pre-position. They'd send them out a couple weeks ahead of time to wherever they wanted them. And then they could serve just as the basic function as ground stations. They moved around a lot, but they didn't get very far, about 16.5 knots. It's pretty slow, but it did the job. And finally, they came up with 8 Apollo-range instrumentation aircraft. And these are the ones I worked with. We had a couple of advantages over the ground stations. The first is our planes flew at 30 to 35,000 feet. And so because of that, we didn't worry about ground scatter at 35,000 feet. Besides, we're out over the ocean anyway. And But the beauty of it was, we could see it much. We could see the satellite much farther when it came over, because actually we could track it for 10 minutes, which is translated to about 2,200 miles. We could track it for 10 minutes. And the other advantage was, if we needed to change something due to an emergency, we could fly, move the planes at 500 miles an hour. In fact, it had right in the it looks kind of funny because it's got that big, large nose on it. And we'll get into that in a minute, but it had a 2 meter, it had a 2 meter diameter dish in it that was extremely mobile. But for some of you, you might recognize it has, it was actually has a certain resemblance to a certain cartoon character. Think Peanuts. It was Snoopy. And so they were actually known as Droop Snoots or Snoopies. Sometimes when the ships were out at sea, they, it was going to be a week or more before they could get their data tapes back to Houston. So what we would do is we would fly a plane over, and they would replay their data tapes that they had captured from the spacecraft. The airplane would record it and keep right on going, and then they could use those tapes at Houston. But let's take a look at the Apollo Range instrumentation aircraft themselves. Like I say, they were known as either Droop Snoots or Snoopies. I know, go ahead, laugh. That's okay. We've done that. But ARIA was the acronym they went by, and it was pronounced ARIA. Okay. Mainly, you know, it's, you could pronounce it ARIA, but that's no op, it's no opera, believe me. Okay. This is a typical four-engine jet, Boeing 707. Hey, it's the early days. Boeing 707. This particular one, we had two airplanes that could carry this pod on the side of it. And it was an optical tracking system. It could track a Volkswagen at about 150 kilometers. I mean, it was that accurate. And it was used particularly in some cases during launches, and it was also used to capture the reentry of Apollo 8 when it came back from the moon. Now, I said it had a 2 meter dish antenna in the nose, and you'll notice this really is kind of an interesting. We had something that the big stations couldn't use or couldn't do. We had, notice in each quadrant, you've got a little antenna like this. There's four of them. And then, of course, we have the main high-speed data antenna in the middle. Well, when the spacecraft came over the horizon, the first thing they would hear was on VHF. And those four VHF antennas were remarkably simple. They would take and balance the signal. And when they balanced the signal on all four, the high-speed antenna was pointed right toward the airplane. Now, once they got it pointed toward the airplane, they started gyroscopes going, so that no matter which way the plane turned or what happened, it would continue to follow the spacecraft across the sky. And what's more, you'll notice, looks like ears on the, you can see the best one on the right, it was yoke mounted. So you had your yoke and you had the antenna in the middle. So not only could it go up and down, it could turn any number of different directions. And if you got near the limits of the antenna when it couldn't turn anymore, solves the problem, you turn the airplane. So it was really kind of neat. Inside, take a look at the inside of the airplane. We had here, you've got down here, here's your antenna in the nose. And we had various equipment. We had UHF, we had one operator, and these are all enlisted people in the Air Force. We had one operator that was dealing with the data that was coming down from the spacecraft in telemetry. We had another position for the guy who controlled the antenna initially and then monitored it. And the mission control was actually an officer. Well, we had to give him a job. He was an officer who was in charge of the whole back-end crew. Next, we had high-frequency communications because early on, when you're out over the ocean, and we didn't really have access to satellites at the time, they would literally run a 100-meter piece of wire out the back end of the aircraft, and the signal would come in through the nose and go through the various filtering, and the voice would go out over this 100-meter antenna. And we had three stations, particularly in the Pacific, for example. We had three stations. We had two run by the Overseas Telecommunications Commission here in Australia, one at Doonside and the other, one station was at Doonside and the other was at Bringelly. And they would take the stronger of the two signals and they would fire it off. We also had a station at Guam and a station at Hawaii. And each one of them are listening to this high-frequency transmission, which was the voices on the astronauts, and they would send them all to Cape Kennedy. We had a man there that would take the strongest signal from the three different sources and send that on to eventually getting to Houston. Then it would go back in reverse the same way when Houston talked to the astronauts. And then timing. All of our tapes had to be timed. Now, we had, I said there was a lot of telemetry data. Most people think of a signal, well, you got a picture and you got an audio, but there was a tremendous amount of digital data that was being, I mean, it was a waterfall. And we had two recorders that could, each one could record 14 channels of data simultaneously. So there was a huge amount of data coming down, and of course these would go onto the tapes. Next, we have our timing position.
Sorry to interrupt. I just say, in those days, everything was recorded on tapes. We didn't have solid-state memory to record things on. So we had big reels of tapes, and they were big tapes, and you could store lots of data on the tapes. Problem is, they were physical. You had to take them somewhere, and you had to play them back to get the data.
Right. Thank you. Finally, we come to timing. We had a rubidium 87 atomic standard that put one track on the tape was always the timing that the event happened. And the event was always relative to the time the rocket lifted off. Because when the rocket lifted off, it started a clock. It was called the ground elapsed time clock. We called it the get clock.
We are at Sandringham College. Where Stan Anderson, the facilities manager for Araya Control, is telling the students about his experiences during the Apollo program.
From Sandringham to South Yarra, you're listening to Southern FM.
And now on the Space Show, we're going to return to Sandringham College and Stan Anderson, the facilities manager for Araya Control.
Everything on the mission was programmed to the minute, which sometimes is okay, but sometimes it can give you some problems. But it was programmed to the minute as to what was supposed to happen on the spacecraft and on the because they knew this, and this plan was developed over a period of months. The stations around the world, because they're on different time zones, the stations on the world could schedule their people to work. Now, it wasn't that they weren't always working; they had basically three crews. You had your prime crew, your second crew, and the third crew. And the prime crew was, if that station, like Goldstone, handled the moon landing. So they had their prime crew on. Okay, Honeysuckle Creek was scheduled to cover the moonwalk, which happened also. It's just that it happened 4 hours early because they had programmed in their infinite wisdom. They said, hey, you're going to land on the moon and you're going to rest for 4 hours before you go for a walk. And when they got there, Neil Armstrong says, ain't going to happen. We're going to go now. And there was havoc, particularly at Honeysuckle Creek, as these guys are trying to catch up, do 4 hours of preparation work, and get them done before Neil Armstrong went to walk on the moon. And then finally, we have our recorders in the back. Like I said, we had two. They had two, and they would record at 120 inches a second for 10 minutes. Huge reels of tape. They were one-inch tape, and they would hold, like I say, 14 channels. Actually, 13 of those were data. There was always one channel for timing. Okay. So conceptually, this was how NASA planned things. Remember, we had that big long gap between Ascension Island and Carnarvon? Well, the signal to go to the moon generally was always planned to go through Carnarvon, and it always did, on the third time around, what we call Revolution 3. And so the spacecraft was in contact with Carnarvon, and you hear him say, go for TLI. That's translunar injection. Light your engine and go to the moon. And Carnarvon would tell him to light the engine. They'd light the engine, but by the time the engine stopped, they were outside of Carnarvon. And so now we've got to fill the gap between. We'll take a look at that later. But basically, they wanted to be able to, during that period of time, 15 minutes, 14 or 15 minutes, NASA had to have contact with the spacecraft. And so, they like 10 minutes before, where's the spacecraft? It's out over the Indian Ocean. No ships there. They put in airplanes. Then for 2 minutes around ignition, and particularly 2 minutes following the engine cutoff, they had to be able to talk to the astronauts because they didn't have any data to tell them how the engine worked. how things work, and so they needed to be able to get reports by voice from after cutoff. And then we operated at two frequencies, very high frequency, which is actually they do a lot of radio with VHF. But they also had this, they developed this thing called Unified S-band, which was really, really high. For those that are radio geeks, it was 2280, the voice was 2287 megahertz, so it was way high. But it allowed them to pack a huge amount of data into a small part, into a signal stream. And then the here you see the aircraft at the maximum slant range was 1,230 miles away, which... That's great, but the satellite's coming over, so actually 1,230 miles one way, that means it's also getting at 1,230 miles coming in the other way. So basically they could travel at nautical miles. So you're probably talking pretty close to 2,500 nautical miles that spacecraft is being tracked. Then, later on, we did get satellite access about Apollo 13, and... Then they could relay again once they started getting phasing into satellite communications. Then they would go direct. We could get rid of the high frequency long wire, which was always kind of dicey. Okay, so you can see they had a specific period of time that NASA really needed to have information. There was another time that again, this is something that could never be covered by a ground station, mainly because they always brought the thing down in the ocean. I mean, hundreds of miles from anywhere. But sure enough, we had three airplanes out there. One would be about 300 kilometers to the north. Another would be 300 kilometers, actually it's about 400 kilometers to the north. One 400 kilometers to the south, and then we had one in the middle. And the one in the middle would be designated the prime aircraft. And when they came out of blackout, the aircraft would first of all they'd pick up the electronic signal, the beams, just the beam, and then Houston would call up and talk to the astronauts and back and forth. Yes, blackout. When they came back from the moon, they actually had a very narrow window. They had to hit the Earth's atmosphere. And as they came through the atmosphere, the spacecraft heated up and it started to ionize the reentry shield, which was insulated. And it would start to flake off, and it created this ionization layer that they couldn't broadcast through, and so it was called blackout. They had to hit the window. They had to hit was a hole in the atmosphere, like 100 miles up. That they had to hit it relative. They couldn't go any less than 3 degrees, and they couldn't go any greater than 7 degrees. So they had a 4-degree window keyhole they had to hit, and. The reason was, if they'd hit it less than 3 degrees, the atmosphere, even at that, as thin as it was, would act like skipping a rock off of the top of water. It would just hit there and bound off, and then they're gone forever. Maybe, hopefully, orbit around the sun. But if they came in greater than 7 degrees, if the G-forces on them, the gravity forces on them that built up, didn't kill them, then the spacecraft would probably burn up anyway. So they had some really narrow tolerances it took to get a man back from the moon. But like I say, one of the jobs of the airplanes, because they were portable and move, they would be out over the in this case they all brought them back over the Pacific Ocean. So, and we'll cover that a little bit later. Okay, so this is where what did we do with the planes? Well, we could put one plane at Ascension Island. This is to cover anything that NASA wanted it to cover during the launch period. It would fly out north, south, but it would fly outside of this range that Ascension Island could see. That looks like it's sitting in the middle of the ocean, and it is. Cocos Island, Keeling Island, either one, take your name, it's both. It's Australian, by the way. So we had a couple of planes at Cocos, had one at Darwin, and another one. Oh, let's put a second one out there at Cocos Island. And the reason is because this is a long span, and so one would fly one way, one would fly the other. I mean, you might find one actually supporting down here and another one supporting right here, but they're passing this signal on from aircraft to aircraft or from station to station, and it all goes back to Houston. We'd put one at Townsville. Now, Townsville could be used as a backup because once they left Carnarvon, and this is the Rev 3 here, they light it here, you follow it all the way up and you don't see it until Hawaii. again, you got to find ways to cover it. So we would normally use the one at Darwin to cover the this place, but we had one at Townsville for a couple of reasons. One, because it would serve as a backup if necessary. If something went wrong, because things go wrong with airplanes, it could back up the one at Darwin. We had a plane up at Guam. It's kind of interesting. Okay, we had a plane in Hawaii. But these are to cover contingencies. Okay, for example, the plane at Guam, actually, and this happened in Apollo 11, it's kind of interesting. You'll notice Rev 3 is down here, but Rev 4, because they always plan to go on Rev 3, but if something went wrong and they could delay it 90 minutes to sort out any problems, then they go on Rev 4. But again, they'd still get the go, no go out of Carnarvon. But oh my golly, look at the space track on Rev 4. It's about 1,300 miles farther west. So they had this, you'll see here later, how they moved the, we had one at Guam that could be plugged in there. Now, the fun part was this. They went on Rev 3. So Guam didn't have anything to do. They had a plane. They were all ready to go. I mean, just ready to fire up the engines, warm up the equipment and go. Well, he didn't get a chance to go. But about 8 days later, he was coming through Hawaii on his way back to Florida, and they says, oh, we've got a job for you. We've got this box of rocks that we need to have dropped at Huntsville, Alabama. He says, whatever you do, don't let it out of your sight. And so they gave it to the mission controller, and I had lunch with him here in Phoenix, Arizona last October. And he says, for 11 hours, he sat right next to that box of rocks because nobody was going to get those lunar rocks away from him. Okay, now, yeah, what happens is, you see, during the mission, we can take this plane at Darwin and move him down into this area here where he can get a much better signal. And you can see at that range, now look at the difference. This is the range that our airplanes could track, but compare it to what's on the ground. So we had a much higher, much longer tracking time with the spacecraft. Okay, during recovery, generally the recovery was out here. No ground stations anywhere near it. So what we could do is we'd take the one at Townsville and we move it over to Nandi in the Fiji Islands. We'd take the one from Guam and we move it to Pango Pango, American Samoa. And Hawaii, we'd move into Pango Pango too, because these three aircraft were going to be the ones that supported the reentry when the mission was over. And they'd fly out into that circle and position themselves accordingly. And here's a good example of the issue with how the planes work. Here you've got the ground track. So we take that one to Darwin and move him down here so he's right in the middle of the circle. They had two other ships. They had two ships in the Pacific. One was the Mercury was at Sydney, and the Redstone was up out of Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. And they could move those in, but sometimes they were using them someplace else. And so quite often, and particularly in the case of Rev 4, what happens is we could move the planes 1,000 kilometers in an hour and a half. And so you can see the dotted lines would be where the coverage, and in this case you can see where that plane that was sitting at Guam would have come into play, because even if one or more of the ships wasn't there, we still had the area covered. Just a very brief finishing up. I worked at Araya Control. I was the facilities manager there. But I had two jobs. One was to make sure the equipment was all operating in the facilities. But I want to show you something. You'll believe, now you got to remember, this is 1960s technology. For Apollo 4, 5, and 6, which were strictly proving the equipment, the lunar module, the command module, the rocket itself, all we had was a worldwide map covered with acetate, and we could go and use tape to put the ground tracks. We even had little icons for the airplanes. That was our technology at the time. And then you'll notice these consoles. Now, what you don't see is this is actually taken from the back of two rooms. And we had the primary staff, the ones that the controllers that are working with the airplanes were in the front room. And in the back room, we had the support people. Now, you'll see a couple of positions there called instrumentation. Common sense is I don't speak airplane. I don't speak electronic equipment. But if we had something go wrong with one of the recorders, we had a crew that was always available to us during a mission, and we could get the recorder man on a position that he could talk directly to the airplane and help resolve the problems. Interesting thing is, that, notice the handsets and the dial. You know, that's what a telephone dial looks like. Okay? Another interesting thing I'll just point out as a matter of interest, we've got all of these lines of switches, and those are different combinations of people that can talk on it. But the first one was what we called Net 1. Net 1 we could never talk on, because that was the one that went, that was the one that the astronauts talked back and forth to Houston with. But Net 2 was the second switch. Okay, second switch. And that was a toggle. You could just press it down and talk to anybody in the network. I mean, in one case, we actually did have a case where we had a reason to call Carnarvon. So we just press it down and say, Carnarvon, Araya Control. We were known as Araya Control. They say, and they'd come back and say, Roger, what can we do? And we'd have our conversation. But like I say, every various combinations were connected to those other switches. Then during Apollo 7, they totally redid our control center. And they gave us computer-driven displays. Our map board was out. They gave us computer-driven displays that were driven by the tracking computers at Houston. And we had a big light display on the right there that actually I had a chance to operate. It was lots of fun. It had 270 switches, because I could take each aircraft. For each aircraft, I could go through each subsystem, whether it was a frequency or recording or whatever. And we had light, red, green, or yellow. And if it was red, you were in trouble. That means somebody, in many cases, if we had an airplane go red, that means it was out of the picture altogether. Red cannot support. But fortunately, we kept most of them green with a little bit of scrambling. So, see, now what we did was also, we took the, get rid of that wall. We actually found the wall was a problem. Because when the controllers needed some information, you had to walk around through a door. So what we did was we put all of the support people in front and all of the control people in the back. It was a much improved thing. That way, if you needed to talk to somebody, you turn around and give them the paper or do what you needed to. Okay, well, this is when our airplanes were back. They were called Snoopies. So when they were all back on the base, we called that the dog pound.
On the Space Show, we have been at Sandringham College, where Stan Anderson, who, as he just told you, was the facilities manager for Araya Control, was telling the students there at Sandringham College about his experiences during the Apollo days. So now we know what A-R-I-A means. And you know the difference, I hope, between Aria and Araya.
From Sandringham to South Yarra, you're listening to Southern FM.
At the beginning of this evening's The Space Show, we heard some of the audio from Apollo 13 and that dramatic re-entry back into the Earth's atmosphere. Would they survive or would they die? And the role that the Araya aircraft played in that. So let's go back to Apollo 13, and here's something that was discovered on an unlabeled reel in the Mission Control Center. And it's been provided by Gene Kranz and is now part of the Johnson Space Center Archive Collection. It's an Apollo 13 parody by some unknown wags, I should call them.
Apollo 13. What started as a routine lunar flight became a mission of high adventure. This is that story. It began with those now famous words.
I don't understand that, sir.
This is Houston. Say again, please.
Houston, we've had a problem.
Don't see any problem, do you?
Negative.
Houston, we've had a problem.
I don't understand that, sir.
We may have had an instrumentation problem, flight.
I don't understand that.
Houston, we've had a problem.
This is a CBS News special report. Trouble has developed aboard Apollo 13.
Nobody knows the trouble I see.
We may have had an instrumentation problem, flight.
I don't understand that.
Trouble serious enough to jeopardize the continuation of the mission.
The LEM water gun was leaking.
I don't understand that, sir.
What all this means is only speculation at this point.
But it took me about 2 days to get my feet dry.
I don't understand that, sir. Bring me up another computer in the RTCC, will you?
Hey, tell Sladen to get his hands off the...
Oh, I'm sorry.
You shouldn't have done that, Deke.
You're right. I guess I haven't been paying much attention to...
And it looks to me, looking out the hatch, that we are bending something.
It's a kind of a failure that can give you a pretty bad day.
Into space.
Crew thinks they're venting something.
Negative flight.
Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home.
So the NASA team swung into action, and on the management level, Christopher Columbus Kraft behaved like the space-hardened veteran he was. Sensing the urgency of the situation, analyzing the data, determining the alternatives, he took the only step possible to a top NASA management official. He called a press conference.
I have a question here for Jim McDivitt. We understand that the spacecraft is out of control, spinning wildly, and that the oxygen is depleted, and the LEM is losing pressure. Is any or all of this correct?
No. I guess I don't understand.
With the water gun leaking, is there any chance of the crew drowning?
You always call the LEM a good lifeboat under those circumstances.
Right, Chris.
Notice you are all sitting there using Ixigenes while you talk. Is there any significance to that?
Because we get rid of quite a bit of weight.
I think we're fat. The bulge in that area.
Right, Chris.
With the disaster on this flight, would all of you be willing to fly on the next Apollo mission?
No, don't think so.
No? You ask me first.
We certainly will reassess that, yes, sir.
Right, Chris.
This is for Slayton. Now, we've heard that the crew, instead of stirring the cryos, armed the pyros and caused this entire problem. Is this true?
No question about it.
And that now they're in the most dangerous situation ever faced by astronauts before?
Yeah.
But I understand that besides their personal danger, their bumbling caused NASA to blow $500 million and endangered the entire Apollo program, cost 100,000 people their jobs, that there's a great threat of a major war if they don't get back. If this is true, what have you got to say for their performance?
They handled it exactly like we'd expect them to.
But they made it a disaster.
I think they did a beautiful job of it.
And the rest of the story we know. Jim Lovell, Jack Swigert, and Fred Hayes made it back to Earth. Heroes in every sense. Greeted by the President of the United States himself. And what was their reaction to his speech?
So you're just going to have to put your fingers in your ears and stand by.
And I'd like to say right now that I've never regretted that. That decision.
And after the debriefings, It was time for celebration.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Truman Capone. And just outside the King's Inn on NASA One, where the party for the Apollo 13 crew is being held. And here comes Glenn Lunny, one of the flight directors for this mission. Glenn, what do you think of this party?
Let me start off by saying that we in the business have probably had the longest night we've had in the space program in a while.
Well, thank you, Glenn. And now here comes Chris Kraft. Tell me, Chris, is there enough booze to go around?
Yes, but I think we'll have to be very frugal in how we use it.
Is it true that you're out of champagne?
I'd say this is as serious a situation as we have ever had in manned space flight.
And here he comes, staggering through the door, the Astro boss himself, Deke Flighton. Say, Deke, baby, it looks like you're having a little problem maneuvering there.
We don't have any problems. We're in good shape.
It does look like you're having a hard time holding on to your martini glass.
Well, that's a tough thing to put a handle on.
Well, are you getting ready to leave the party?
Yeah.
Well, have a good drive home, and I hope you make it safely.
But you can't discount the fact that something else might crap out on you before you get home, you know?
Right. Thanks a lot, Deke. And now here comes Jack Swigert and Jim Lovell. Would you mind stepping over here a moment, boys?
Okay.
Oops. Just spilled your drink on me there.
Excuse me.
Well, now tell me, how did you feel getting back home again here to MSC, effectively knowing about the coming rift?
It's almost awesome in its desolation.
Oh. And how do you feel about your mission?
I felt that we had a good mission, and its success, I think, is well documented.
Yes. And now, Captain Lovell, what do you think was the most critical system of all the complex systems on board the disabled spacecraft?
The urine system?
We've already been told by Jim what color it is.
Well, Captain Lovell, how's the party going?
I think it's amazing the way that people can respond so fast to get this job done.
Right. And one more question. I understand that this has been a nerve-wracking mission. Captain Lovell, what would it take to make you get into a spacecraft again?
I wouldn't be scared to fly with the fix.
And now, here he comes, the most famous person at the party. Excuse me, sir, oh, I'm so excited. But I take it that the party is going well. What is your opinion of the drinks being served in there?
Theirs is the spirit that filled America.
Glory, hallelujah.
But perhaps what will live forever from Apollo 13 are those immortal words.
We may have had an instrumentation problem, Frank.
I don't understand that, sir.
That was the Apollo 13 parody from 50 years ago, and that is now part of the Johnson Space Center archive collection. And remember that 50 years ago, they did not have digital editing. It was done by splicing reel-to-reel tape together. And I remember doing that some years ago, but fortunately, we've now got digital recording. Well, we've just got time, I think, to squeeze in a song called Jim Lovell's Lament, So Near and Yet So Far. It's about how Jim Lovell and his crew came so close to the moon, yet couldn't land.
A bang, a shimmy, shakes a tiny space. We've had a problem, Houston, no one's had to face. Look out the porthole, at the moon's unblinking eye. A billion hearts are praying, we feel every word they say, but we will refuse, yes, we will refuse, we will refuse, yes, we will refuse this chance to die. So near yet so far, so near yet so far, so near yet so far. Down to earth we are descending, touch not the moon, my dreams are ending. So near yet so far. My fears condensing on the instrument, the dials and the switches sing a sad lament. Now our minds together, our brains are sharper knife. Pencils, paper, slide rule flashing, numbers multiply, dividing, and we calculate. Yes, we calculate, we calculate, yes, we calculate to save our lives. So near yet so far, so near yet so far, so near. Down to earth we are descending, touch not the moon, my dreams are ending, so near yet so far. A slingshot ride back towards our roots. I'm not to feel the dust beneath my boots. We're a falling star set in the sky above. There'll be no lunar landing, my family. I am returning. We're coming home. Yes, we're coming home. I'm coming home. Yes, I'm coming home to you, my love. So near yet so far. So near yet so far. So near yet so far. Down to earth we are descending, touch not the moon, my dreams are ending. So near yet so far. 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 Down to earth we are descending, touch not the moon, my dreams are ending. So near yet so far.
from Scotland. That's Arbelos. Jim Lovell's Lament.